welcome to the seventh season of Scene to Song, a musical theater podcast for people who love to discuss, critique, and celebrate musicals as a literary art form. I'm your host, Shoshana Greenberg, and each episode I'll bring on a guest to talk about a musical, musical theater writer, or a topic or trend in musical theater. My guest today is Jason K. Purdy. Jason is a book writer, lyricist, and composer whose musicals include Sweet Nothings, Enjoy the Ride, The Puzzling Disappearance of Ying Jing Via, Or the Whale, adapted from Moby Dick, an adaptation of Wings of the Dove, and Blood by the Mummers. A 2021-2022 Klee Band Award finalist, he is also the animator, writer, and producer of Mandy and Mort. He received his MFA from the Graduate Musical Theater Writing Program at NYU. We're going to talk today about neurodivergence and disability representation in The Light in the Piazza. Hey, Jason, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast.
Hello, thank you for having me back.
Well, we'll get started with our Get to Know Our Guest questions. What was the last great musical you saw?
I saw Six a week ago.
Oh, yeah.
I took my wife to see it for Valentine's Day, and well, it was technically her Christmas present on Valentine's Day. So I like to think that I got to two birds.
Yeah.
I was thoroughly impressed. I thought I was going to just be like, oh, well, that was fun. But I really, really loved a lot about it. Just from the concert style to it daring to be shorter than 90 minutes. I still felt like a full evening, a full experience to me. Really, really smartly written, and just shows that you can do the bombastic pop fun thing and still write a thoughtful show.
Yeah. What is a musical people would be surprised to find out you love, and why would they be surprised?
A lot of people would be probably less surprised now, but I love Wicked. And I think my brain turned around on it like 10 years ago or so. Like I was like 23 when it opened, and I was definitely surrounded by a lot of like, I had a lot of friends who were losing their mind over it, and then I had a lot of friends who were just being super snobby about it, and I decided to be super snobby about it. That's just silly. That's just all style, all bombast and no substance and stuff like that. And since then, I've like heard Winnie speak multiple times about the show, about the genesis of the show, and I found that very impressive. I've seen it, four times now? Yeah, four times now. Mm-hmm. Part of my now bias toward the show is the fact that my brother's been in the national tour and he's been in it on Broadway now just this past year. So I've seen it twice in the past year just to see him go.
Nice.
My brother Dave's got pretty, very talented. Use him for everything. So yeah, a little bit bias there for the show. But no, I was tilting in that direction before. So there are definitely friends who are just like, I thought you hated that. I'm just like, no, I love it. The Wicked Witch of the East scene is the most acrobatic piece of book writing that has ever been put on stage.
Is there a classic show you saw recently for the first time, and what was your experience with it?
I did have the opportunity to work at the Music Man revival.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely saw how... The show is so good. The show is very, 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 very good. It's just dramatic. Everything about that show was really just locked in. And so that actually, to me, makes it really, really clear when the people coming to the table have no other ideas for it. Like that production just seemed very much like, we don't have to try. I am 150% sure that the designers and everybody involved with that and everybody with their boots on the ground for that show worked their asses off on that show. I wouldn't disparage their work. But just from like a top-down level, it just felt very, Hugh Jackman's doing it, so.
Right.
We don't really have to put in much. I don't need like a sexy Oklahoma version of The Music Man. I don't need that type of I feel like Oklahoma really benefited from that. I felt like that subtext was in that show. But you can also do something like the Hello Dolly revival, and that was just as the most Hello Dolly thing it could have been. And it was fine. It was perfectly serviceable. And it didn't feel like I was going through the motions. The one part of the show I paid the most attention to when I worked Music Man was Iowa Stubborn, because that's my favorite song in the show. And I was like, oh, this is the movie. You're just doing the movie. These people deserve better. So, yeah, it was disappointing.
What moves you the most in a work of musical theater?
Anything that's trying to do a little something extra. Because you know that those creatives, you know that those writers are in the room fighting for that extra. Mm-hmm. kind of a little bit pertains, I think, to a bit of our discussion with How to Dance in Ohio as well. Because there's certain very subtle things happening in the book of that show that I feel like there must have been pressure on them to not have, that I very strongly respect them for having. But yeah, anything that's coming to the table and saying, this is a craft and everything, and there is a way that this has been done and then a way it has worked well, but also what if we don't, you know?
Who are the musical theater writers you admire most?
I love Howard Ashman, Dorothy Fields. I went down like a rabbit hole of her during COVID, listening to just looking at her career and being insane, being blown away by her as a person. The fact that she walked up to Rodgers and Hammerstein one day at a party and was just like, hey, you know, there should be an Andy Oakley musical. And a year later, they produced one. And gone through writer changes and stuff like that. And her just sense of the craft and working with all the different collaborators she did. Yeah. She's underrated. I saw a list recently of musical theater writers, and she wasn't on it, and it pissed me off. Anybody who's just doing what the majority of us are doing and is just writing in our little apartments and just trying to keep going when all of our avenues are continually shut off toward that for us, or seeing that the biggest producer of our work is leaning toward things that are far more commercially viable, which is arguable, I guess, considering how much things close. My favorite musical theater writers is all my friends.
That's always also a good answer, especially when, you know, if you know a lot of people writing musical theater, and you know that their work is out there, or should be more out there, but is still, you know, out there. That
you see people post on social media, gosh, where are the people? Nobody's writing good story, good blah, blah, blah anymore. I'm just yes, they are. There's so many. Know.
What is your favorite lyric line in musical theater?
Today? It is, don't let my sorrow make evil of me, from Carolina Change.
Oh, yeah. I was like, wait, that's so familiar. What is that? Yes.
Such a perfect way of phrasing, like, everything that I think attracts me to storytelling, and the thing that I kind of, like, find myself focusing in and on, honing in on when writing. I'm very, very fixated, I guess, on this sounds so pretentious. The tension between hope and despair. It's not. It's just, it literally is like every story from back to the beginning of time. It's Carousel. It's Hadestown. And everything in between. The whole idea of making my pain somebody else's pain is like that is the worst thing that another person can do. That is, that evil isn't this monumental thing. It's very mundane, and it is something that's built within you, and it's an enviable lyric to me. But to land that song, to land Lot's Wife on Don't Let My Sorrow Make Evil of Me, kills me every time.
Yeah, that's a good one. Oh, great. Let's move into our topic, which is neurodivergence and disability representation in The Light and the Piazza. So let's start with, you saw the City Center Encores production in last June, which started you on this topic.
I just went to see the show because I love Ruthie and because I'd always wanted to see the show. And for some reason, it had not really occurred to me what I would be seeing, because like just the life story catch up for me since since the last time I saw you in this capacity is that I've figured out late identified autistic. ADHD, that's no surprise to anybody, but I have ADHD and I'm autistic and I'm 43 and I figured that out all of 2 or 3 years ago. It's actually really funny because anytime I come out, so to speak, to someone, their response tends to be, oh, okay. So it's not so much that they're just accepting of it. They're just not at all surprised. This is actually probably the first like really super public way I'm speaking about it. So I'm just realizing that now as I'm saying that. That was figured out through therapy, lots of exploration and Googling and TikToks and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So that's been in my head and that's been a big part of just me existing as an artist and as a human for the past 2 or 3 years is just kind of reevaluating my entire life, my life as an actor, yeah. My life as a writer, problems I had as an actor that I probably wouldn't have had this not been the case, from sensory problems to social problems. It's a subject I still can't really talk to my mother about because she's just like, no, you're not. Because I was a gifted kid. I got all A's and I went to the special gifted classes where we played board games to keep us out of the way. So she just doesn't, since I did well, since I wasn't the squeaky wheel, my other brother, the one who's not in Wicked, he's definitely also autistic as well. And my mother has admitted that, has acknowledged that. But he would just be on that other end of the spectrum where his traits caused him to struggle. So mine didn't cause me to visibly struggle. And then until like high school or whatever, middle school, high school, when I had to struggle privately with a lot of things, whether it was learning problems or just social difficulties. And this trying to be learning how to person. Like many, I turned to theater to learn how to person. I come into like the Piazza, like not having I knew that I knew the story. I knew that Clara had suffered a traumatic brain injury as a child. And that's like a big point of the story. So like I did kind of have it in the back of my head. Oh, I hope this doesn't make me cringe the entire time because it's bad representation. And I found the exact opposite to be true. And I found it to be incredibly moving. I had to get the audiobook and listen to that as well, because it's ahead of its time in the way it speaks about disability. Even keeping through it in Margaret Johnson's perspective. I don't know if Craig Lucas just accidentally ended up writing this show so progressively. I'm just like, when so much attention was supposedly paid to sensitively handling the neurodivergent issues in other recent shows, and I did not see that on the stage at all in those, it's shocking to me that this little operetta that popped up in 2005 that I had been meaning to see forever just was showing so astutely this view of a young neurodivergent woman who is an adult who has been like, there's a lot of talk now in the community in the autistic and just disabled community about the antiquated nature of the phrase of mental age, intellectual age, mental age, and discussing anything like that. It's very problematic, and it just does not serve the people that you're speaking of very well. And that's up with Clara in Piazza, where it's just like, oh, she'll never be mentally older than 12. And it's just like, well, that's everybody around her telling her that.
Right.
But then throughout the show, she is very clearly acting in such a way that is saying, I want my own agency. I want my own life. I want, like, for a pre-Me Too show, like, to have so much in that show making it clear that she wants Fabrizio. She right. wants the boy. from the proposal to the sex to everything about that relationship. That show makes it clear that we are going with what this young woman wants for herself, and giving her that agency and giving her that choice without infantilizing her. There are people around her who want to infantilize her. Her father certainly infantilizes her. That was the way they did that in the City Center production was hard. The actor had to say some rough stuff. And I admired them for making it so harsh, because it's so funny, because I thought this about How to Dance in Ohio as well. If you spend so much time with these characters without thinking about their disability so much at the forefront of their existence, and then somebody comes in and immediately just drops the prejudice, drops the ableism, and drops all of the real world shit on your head, it's jarring. It's more jarring. Like, it's that way in How to Dance in Ohio when the blog is written. I feel like it's that way when Clara's father is on the phone with her mother in Piazza.
Right. Well, I did see this in 2005 when it premiered, and it's so fascinating to watch it now and realize, like, back then, like, it didn't even occur to me that this was about neurodiversity, about anything like that. I grew up, my brother has autism, he's autistic, and on the very high support needs and area of the spectrum, and so I've, you know, that's been in my life, but yeah, it didn't occur to me when I saw it in 2005 that was even related to but then watching it now, after, I guess there's been a lot of conversations, and the conversation has become, it's changed or become more to, has come more to the forefront. And to me, it's so obvious that that is what this show is about.
Funny. Show knocked me down a little rabbit hole of, I had to immediately listen to the novella. I primarily just do audiobooks at this point. And then that sparked a connection in my head to start looking up things about Rosemary Kennedy. Because I find Clara and Rosemary Kennedy very analogous to each other. I think Clara's neurodivergence is attributed entirely to a traumatic brain injury for our listeners. kicked in the head by a horse when she was a kid, and the doctors basically said she's going to be intellectually disabled for the rest of her life. And it's funny, in the movie there's a movie though. In the show and in the novella, Margaret Johnson continually she's very skeptical about that. She's saying, they said this, but she's doing that. They said this about her, but she's doing that. It's fascinating, the progressive of the book, because I didn't expect to read anything from the 50s like that. To know that at the same time that Joseph Kennedy was having his daughter lobotomized, that this woman was writing this book where it's just like, hey, my daughter got kicked in the head by a horse, but she's fine. think that had someone like Rosemary Kennedy lived in a different context, she would have had a better life after what happened to her. Not what happened to her would not have happened to her is what I mean.
Right.
And
the being lobotomized, you mean?
Yeah. The thing with Clara is things that she observes are very autistic feeling traits, I guess. She has dysgraphia, her handwriting's terrible. mood swings, meltdowns. She has persistent headaches because she has traumatic brain injury. And the fact that she acts very young for her age, so, are things that Margaret talks about. But there's never really, it's so funny because like one gets into this very touchy territory, I feel like, when talking about characters like this in relation to intellectual or cognitive impairments, because you don't want the thing to be, how dare you say this character is intellectually disabled? There's nothing wrong with being intellectually disabled. It's just more about being correct about what the thing is and what is going on with this person. And I know that my mother has worked in special education for most of her life. And I asked her at some point about, I basically was just like, hey, if the root of a lot of these difficulties is social with intellectually disabled kids, then why cloister them all together and not have them among other kids for further social development? And bullying's the big reason. But my mother was just like, oh, that's, yeah. My mother was straight up just like, no, it's stupid and we shouldn't have been doing it. Because she was explaining that the kids with Down syndrome that she'd worked with had been, as they'd been integrating into their classes, were performing better. And Piazza makes me think of this, and Ohio to an extent and all, like, but Piazza particularly, this whole idea of you're going to, how you're treated can affect how much you can grow, how far you can go, who you can become.
Right.
How much the context of where you are. I think it's really, really funny that all of the things that makes Clara awkward in America just makes her Italian.
Yeah.
I realized that, like, looking back, I'm just like, oh, the book really makes it clear. I feel like it's just like, no, they're used to this because the social norms are different. So right. You just move the template from one place to another and suddenly she's alive and thriving and nobody even suspects that she has any quote unquote issues. Even her meltdown, her outburst is kind of being like, nah, that's the most Italian thing you've done since you got here. Like,
right. Yeah, they set it up. You think it's going to ruin everything with the family and they're like, yes, you're right. Good for you.
It's just like how much of what people have to go through is external. Like I said this to my wife at some point last week after she'd seen How to Dance in Ohio. And I was thinking about how the lives of neurodivergent folks, whether autistic, ADHD, intellectually disabled, Tourette's, schizophrenic, schizoaffective, just depressed. Can be massively benefited simply by people just being kind to each other, like giving each other grace.
I was thinking, like, during while I was revisiting it, I just wondering what Clara's life has been like in North Carolina since the accident, because when her mother is describing the party to the audience, it's like she was with her friends and all her friends were there, and it's like,
where are those
friends? Where are those friends? Like, has she had friends? Has she had people in her life besides her mother and her father all this time? Yeah. And it just makes those scenes with the family so much more, I don't know, emotional, but like also like she's found like more people, you know, to have in her life.
Yeah. And she's found it so guilelessly and organically that it's such a fascinating piece to watch, because like, I feel like in different writers' hands, like, to be fair, I mean, the text doesn't support the very typical, I feel like, way that I feel like the story would be told by someone trying to homogenize it, I guess, for that Margaret would be more in the way, more of a helicopter mom, more of an autism spectrum mom. that that there would be. But the fact that Margaret the entire time, she knows, she sees her daughter, like, and she's not, it's not hard to convince her, because she knows her daughter, and she wants her daughter to be able to, like, to be able to live on her own and have all of the things that she wants in her life. Like, if I think that that's an important thing in disabled, in the story, in telling disabled stories, is it's not about making people do things that they cannot do. It's about making people's disabilities, not taking the obstacles that exist because of those disabilities away from people in their achieving of what they want to achieve, and being where they want to be in their lives.
I want to talk about some of the songs in Light in the Piazza, starting with Clara's first song, The Beauty Is, which is such a great first song for her.
You've now song bombed me with Beauty Is, by the way. That, not just the song, just like the ostinato at the beginning. Like, it's the most, talk about putting somebody's entire character in a, into two bars of music. That definitely ties into, I think, what I was saying earlier about how she just gets along with Italians better.
Yeah. Yeah, right in the first verse or stanza, she's contrasting Italian or something in Italy with something in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. These are very popular in Italy, the land of naked marble boys.
These are very popular.
There's, you also get the, like, the little suggestion of the budding sexuality there, like that you're not just listening to a woman child. I mean, to be fair, you don't expect that, you haven't heard any of that about her yet. So she's just a young woman in a new city who's excited to be there. I love the whole, the beauty is I still meet people I know. The fact that she's so friendly and guileless, and she, I like that a lot.
Yeah, she's a very open person.
And it seems like wherever she's from, Winston-Salem, they're not. It's a thing that brings me back to the Rosemary Kennedy thing too, where it's like you hear people talk about her, her friends and her siblings were like, she was fine. They just didn't want her out in the society because she didn't act, she didn't put on the airs, she didn't quite understand how to do the performance of being whatever it was that they wanted people to think that they were. And it just sounds like, it's just, she's entered into a whole different type of world where people look at her differently and she feels it. I love the whole, that they get to, you get a lot of her and her art for the show, funnily enough, in this, in terms of realizing that you are seeing that you are talking to a grown woman with wishes and hopes and plans for her own life. From, I think if I had a child, I would take such care of her that I wouldn't feel like one. Contrast that with her father telling her, saying she would just drop a baby later is so upsetting. She's like, no, she would take such care of her. It shows that she, I think you see a lot of that she's struggling against the infantilization of having had to go through her adolescence kind of wrapped in bubble wrap. And it's funny because it's kind of you kind of get the Finding Nemo vibe from Margaret Johnson, the whole, like, I don't want, oh my God, I just compared Finding Nemo to Light the Piazza. Oh my God, it makes sense. That he doesn't want to let him, don't want, it's nice because it's the ultimate relatable story. No parent wants to let their child go.
Right.
And then when you add in a few more layers of trauma to it,
yeah.
Ruthie Ann Miles pulling off that her, the reprise of this is one of the most harrowing things I've ever seen on stage. She went places for that, and I don't know where how she did it, but she was remarkable. Yeah. This is wanting something. This is praying for it.
I'm just a someone in an old museum, far away from home as someone can go. And the beauty is I still meet people I know. Hello, this is wanting something, this is reaching for it, this is wishing that a moment would arrive. This is taking chances, this is almost touching what the beauty is. I don't understand a word they're saying. I'm as different here as different can be. But the beauty is I still meet people.
The lyrics kind of are so funny from this song to me because they kind of swirl around the point. And I really, really relate to that, both with my lyrics and with how my brain works. And the music kind of does that with her until it just kind of arrives and until it finds something and then it like jumps off of it. And then, yeah. But when it gets to the whole, this is wanting something, this is... It just really feels like a revelation to her when she says this is wanting something.
Yeah, even like the title, the hook of the song, and the beauty is, if that kind of goes with your point about circling around, like the beauty is what, like kind of thing.
Where are you going with this, Clara?
Right.
There's always the better rhymed, sharper, wittier, more like... I hate to say Sondheim-y because I feel like Sondheim would hate it. lyric for these moments, but this is the lyric for this moment. She doesn't have punchlines. She just is. It's just full on stream of consciousness.
Yeah. Although that line, if I think the one you talked about, I think if I had a child, I would take such care of her, then I wouldn't feel like one. That really lands.
Oh yeah. And then the whole, I don't understand a word they're saying, I'm as different here as different can be, but the beauty is I still meet people like me. I think she's really recognizing that. I think she, the whole like, Italy's different than America thing is something that makes Margaret go, nope. And Clara seems to be just really tuned into very quickly.
Yeah. One thing that talking about this and this show in general has been making me think about is like with stories about or characters with neurodivergence in all forms, like this show is kind of about also what happens when you take language out of the equation. Mm-hmm. It kind of like puts them on equal footing in a way, mm-hmm. or like she doesn't need to have any type of language that is any standard, yeah. you know, like, and he doesn't have to, you see him struggling to communicate way more than you see her struggling to communicate in the show.
And that very suddenly you see her learning Italian very quickly throughout.
Right.
Like, not even jarringly so, like you just, she picks it up. Again, the show frames it so nicely that you're told these things about Clara that she's unable, that she's disabled, that she's unable to learn, that she's whatever. But she's in a new country and she's learning Italian faster than her mother, who was studying the books. Like, who's like looking at the book, the phrase books and everything. Right. But she's just organically learning it from Fabrizio. She's able to communicate reasonably well in Italian near the end, I believe. Mm-hmm. And that's the same way in the novella, as she remarks on the fact that Clara and them have all conversations while I'm just sitting there. She has to. She's interested. She wants to. And so she just does.
Yeah.
I don't think she's ever had that opportunity before.
Right. I wanted to also talk more about Clara and Margaret's relationship. I mean, that's basically, I guess, the crux of the show in a way, mm-hmm. is Margaret letting go of Clara, and Clara, I mean, she's going full steam ahead with what she wants, but she also like has these moments of like, can I really leave my mother? Mm-hmm. And yeah, especially the last line before the last song, when she's about to get married, I don't think I can leave you, or something like that. And she was like, yes, you, and she's like, yes, you can. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's also where the show lands in that relatable spot that I think a lot of the stuff in How to Dance in Ohio does as well, where it is, these are things we all must deal with. Like, mm-hmm. Every child has to do the whole, can I leave the parent thing? Mm-hmm. Or can I leave the person who has cared for me my entire life? Every parent has to deal with, can I handle letting her go? I don't think I ever fully understood the song Fable until I saw this production. Mm-hmm. And funnily enough, How to Dance in Ohio, after the fact, it helps me a little bit more understanding it in retrospect. Because I'm just like, where are you going? Because she's just rambling to me through a lot of that song.
Yeah.
I'm just like,
it does feel like that a lot. Yeah.
I'm just like, she and I love lyrics like that. I love lyrics where I just feel like I'm just getting a stream of consciousness of the person trying to figure this shit out, because it just is relatable content.
You can look in the ruins for a wishing well, for a magic apple, for a cherry or tear, for a fable of love that will carry you to a moon on a hill, to a hidden stream, a lagoon and a red horizon dream, silhouette set away from time forever, to a valley beyond the setting sun, where water shine and horses run, where there's a man who looks for you. But while you look, you are changing, turning, you're a well of wishes, you're a fallen apple. No, no, love's a fake, love's a fable.
The song Terminally Human and How to Dance in Ohio, where they ask, what if everything's a disaster, about the formal, and he replies with, disaster is always a possibility, and then mm-hmm. victory is always also a possibility. That to me is like, you go back to Fable and love's a fable, like, get what you can while you have it, like, live and mm-hmm. love. You have this thing right now in front of you, okay, have it. Like,
yeah.
She's already seen her marriage is disintegrating and everything, and well, not her marriage. I wouldn't say her marriage is disintegrating. Her feelings are disintegrating for her husband.
Their relationship, the Margaret and her husband, is also very interesting in this, because she, I think she's just finally confronting the fact that there are problems, and that she, her feelings are disintegrating, and like she's acknowledging it for the first time, kind of thing.
She definitely seems to be there seems to be something cynically optimistic between the lines of Fable to me, but where it's, what if it, the whole what if it doesn't work out? What if it doesn't work out? Yeah. What if it goes badly? What if she will have still had a life? She's still having a life. She's still having a life that's her own. She's still making her own decisions. She's still, the mistakes that she makes are her, are hers. And those are, and that's somehow valuable. If shacking up with an Italian boy at 28, who's 18, doesn't go well for her, then it doesn't go well. It doesn't go well for a lot of people.
Well, she's, because they do say the ages. She's 26 and he's 20. Yeah.
I think it's the age.
Yeah. Oh, close enough. But yeah, but that, and also because that becomes the humorous plot point of the whole time, Margaret is so worried that they're going to find out that she is, you know, this mentally aged 10 or 12 or whatever. And what ends up being the reason that his father does almost doesn't let it happen is that she's actually 26. And he's like, that's too old for my son. He was 20. Right.
And you think that like there's going to be some also reaction of like some understanding of, oh, and she's 26 and she acts, but she acts like she's 18 or something like that. But like, no, they don't care.
Yeah, it's the fact that she's too old, not that she's mentally too young. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anything to say about Clara and Fabrizio's relationship. I mean, we kind of touched on most of it already, I guess, but there's a simplicity to that relationship, but there's also a really like deep understanding and like complexity as well, like going on at the same time, which I find really interesting. Like it's simply like, I love you, you love me, let's get married. Like, this is like, we've like, love it. It's like a love at first sight.
Yeah, they get each other immediately. And
the
rest is just paperwork.
Yeah. Right. But yet there's like all these, like, she's kind of like understanding what an adult relationship is, like that there could be infidelity, that she, to be in this relationship, she is going to have to transition away from living with her mother, that there is going to be that separation that she's going to have to deal with, like all those things, like she's, are going on for her, you know, it's still complex, but it's also like this very simple, like, just, we love each other, we want to be together, that's it.
We sing, we love.
Yeah. I also wanted to touch on his father, Signor Naccarelli, as well. Just, we mentioned him briefly, but I just also thought it was interesting. Like, it's not just the parents of neurodivergent people who are holding their kids back. You know, like, I just thought that was nice to see too. Mm-hmm. Like, it's all parents. Oh, yeah. All parents are ridiculous in certain ways. Like having the whole age thing be a hang up for him, and like just not, like, he has as much control over his son as she does over her daughter. Like, it's like there's kind of like an equalizing element there.
Yeah, he's such a peculiar character, because like he's a little bit, the show de-skeeves him a little bit. He's a little less skeevy in the show than he is in the book, I feel like. He's an amazing vessel to show the massive difference between the cultures, I feel like. But he does seem like kind of a weird intersection of his sons, in terms of there is a sweetness to him still, but he's very cynical. He's, but so is Margaret too. So it's an interesting reflection. Yeah. He makes a very interesting reflection for Margaret. And I feel like Ruthie Ann Miles definitely played that she was seeing that she was trying to navigate something with him in terms of like, what are you, what am I seeing in you that is so clearly also in me as well? Yeah, the sexual tension between them and the show was amazing. And I think that he also kind of is a little bit of a force for igniting a little bit of her. I mean, I think the big force for igniting her, Margaret's need to be like, okay, maybe I need a life of my own now, is Clara and her husband being a dink. But Signor Naccarelli definitely seems to play a big part in that. She was just like, oh, look, I'm feeling things that I haven't felt in a long time. Even if it's more primal things.
The show really I feel like they use every character. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe that comes from the novel, but I feel like, yeah, each character has a role to play in Clara's, in this story for her.
Yeah, it's a little tug of war, one direction, the other direction. Like, yeah, to see how they all influence each new moment of the show. Usually whenever we're looking at something from 10, 15 years ago and going, oh, we don't feel that way now, or looking at, oh, that's aged poorly, like, it's nice to see something age well. It's rare.
Yeah. Right.
Like, I saw Zorba at City Center when they did that, which my brother was in it, and he definitely came up to me after the show and was just like, so, what? I'm just like, well, they murdered a woman in the square because she couldn't get with the intellectually disabled man.
Oh my gosh.
So, yeah, aged like milk. But mm-hmm. Mira Maisie was spectacular, so, of course. But, yeah, there's so many things like that. Then there's things that are still getting written that are not great about that either.
Let's move into our next section. Why is this so good? We're going to talk about the song Drift from How to Dance in Ohio. So, yeah, why did you pick this song for Why is This So Good?
I picked this because I love How to Dance in Ohio. And because it's, I thought it paralleled The Light in the Piazza very nicely. It paralleled Clara very nicely. Mm-hmm. It's Meredith singing top of act two. She's been given a pebble. You know, penguins give pebbles. She's been given a pebble. And the pebble is a book by Drew, the leading man in the show. And he'd meant to ask her to the formal that they're hoping to go to and have, but instead he just gave her a book that he hoped she'd like, because he had noticed what she was interested in, which is honestly the best freaking thing you could do for a neurodivergent person. It's like, I pointed out to my wife as Madison Kopeck walked off stage with the book that night. Like, it was so funny. That was the third time I'd seen the show, and I watched Liam Pierce be devastated and Madison Kopeck hold that book like it had the cure for everything. And it was such a great little acting moments from both of them.
I remember that. I loved how she held that book. Yeah.
And similarly to Beauty Is, I really feel like it is this young woman just kind of processing, what am I allowed to want now? I feel like I feel like this is the case for everybody. I certainly have felt like it's the case for me, whether it's from like a lived experience, trauma, childhood thing or whatever. Like, the place where this is most clearly relatable to me is, funnily enough, with musical theater writing, I'm realizing, because that was not a thing that I just thought was for me. That is a thing that, and I kind of have, for better or worse, love you, Mom, my mother's voice in my ears saying, oh, you do this. You're the one who does this. It's parents being like, trying to keep up with their kids. And I just would get in this place where I didn't, my brain's really, really stringent about these things. So like, anytime somebody would say something to me, be like, well, why don't you just? My response is almost 100% of the time, I did not know that was an option. And a place where I relate to a lot of another character in How to Dance in Ohio is with Caroline, who's got her first boyfriend, but it's a toxic relationship. My first relationship was a toxic relationship. It was a lovely young woman at the time who came up to me and basically said, "Hi, we're friends now." And I was just like, okay, that's what boys do. And as the relationship progressed, she was like, okay, we're dating now. Okay, that's what I do. Like, that's really how I was just like, okay, I'm doing the things I'm supposed to do. I'm adulting. I'm performing person. And the relationship ended up being very, not good. And ending poorly. Mm-hmm. When I have not been able to finish, personally, the How to Dance in Ohio documentary yet, the movie that the musical is mm-hmm. based on. Partially because in the first couple minutes of it, you hear, I believe Meredith say, "I don't like people touching me." And I believe Dr. Amigo responds with, "Well, we're going to cure you of that." And in case you weren't aware of, and I mean, I know you are aware, Shoshana, outside of the neurodivergent community, outside of the autistic community specifically, but that is a no-no now. Respecting our boundaries is a big, big thing. We don't want to be cured. It was just very triggering. And I was just like, I don't know if this is going to go the way I want it to or I need it to. So I backed off of it. And I honestly just don't know if it tracks the same way it does in the show. If it does, it actually makes perfect sense. Because the show makes it very clear that Meredith has been put into this comfort zone. It lives in her little comfort zone and doesn't leave it. And her father wants her to leave it because her father wants her to have a life of her own. But he even says in the show, he's just like, "I was pretty sure it was just going to be you and me forever." which is something my mother used to say about one of my brothers. But she expresses the interest, she expresses the need. So like I feel like a lesson that neurotypicals can take away from, can mistakenly or misguidedly take away from something like How to Dance in Ohio is that, oh, just force them out of their comfort zone. Throw them in the pool, they'll learn to swim. That's not it. The point is taking the obstacles out of the way for us, for anyone to do the thing that they want to do. Making them comfortable in the space, making them feel like the space is for them, making them feel accommodated. And that's what ultimately happens in How to Dance in Ohio. Meredith is feeling this over the course of the show, like as she's getting closer with the other kid, other young people in the group and everything. Because she's very much, they make it very much, very clear, if she does not want to do something, she will not do it. She will just leave. So when she sticks around for something, that means something. When she speaks up, that means something. When you get the final moment of the show where she just touches Drew's hand, it means the universe, because she wants this for herself. Not because her parents do, not because we live in a society people do. Like, she wants it. And there should be nothing keeping her from getting that. A long way of saying I really like the song. the song's just her response to getting a book from a boy. And it beautifully interpolates some of her leitmotifs as well that kind of follow her through the show.
There's the line like hands that hold in there. Like she's thinking about that in the song, it looks like.
Can't pay attention to what's on the page. The window keeps catching my eye. Watching the puffiest cumulus clouds drift by. This book is full of phenomenal facts, the kind that I really enjoy. This book I got from a friend who is also a boy. No purpose on their path, just doing what clouds do. They
says the continents all will collide in 300 million years or so. When they do, Malibu Beach will be full of snow.
And also she's talking about like tectonic shifts. She's talking about continents, which you look like they don't move, but do move. And she's clearly making the correlation between these continents slowly but surely inching toward each other. And how even like the most massive things on the planet can move, like, and she's, and I feel like her, that definitely is her seeing herself and like, okay, can I drift too?
Yeah, it's such a great metaphor, because like, yeah, tectonic shifts, you hear that, you that's a huge change, but it's not anything that's perceptible.
Yeah. I can't wait to hear more from what Jacob and Rebecca do, because everything in this show is stunning to me.
Yeah, I also love, and I feel like the audience did too, when she ends one of the stanzas just with fact. Because she talks about, you know, that she loves facts. This book is full of facts. And then she uses fact in that other way, like, fact.
Focus on the facts, but I can't make my limbs relax. Continental drift. What do I do with this new information? What meaning should I extract? I've always been better with books than with people. Fact.
So Drew's shown her that he is like, you shouldn't go out with the boy just because the boy wants to go out with you. But this boy really seems to get you. You probably could talk about fun stuff for a while and have a good time. And relating it all to her special interest and swirling it back around. That's another, I feel like maybe that's another reason why I keep using that swirling analogy, is that I do feel like her lyrics tend to swirl a little bit as well. That's even in the 6-8 movement of the, it's a 6-8 song, right?
I think the song of hers that I remembered from the show more was the other one, Unlikely Animals. Mm-hmm. Is that what it's called? Yeah. And I didn't remember this one as well, but this is also such a great song. Mm-hmm. I mean, my favorite songs in that show were the ones that were just like the characters, the autistic characters, like getting these moments where you could really get inside them.
Yeah. And I love the fact that they all kind of have their little step outs. Reincarnation is such a smart, subtle piece of the set. Third time I saw that show, like I became very team Imani for a featured actor Tony nomination, because they really settled into that role in an easy way. Like, and they were still hitting the back of the house with just very subtle choices and stuff. And it's just such a great performance. I mean, they all gave amazing performances in that show. It's just, I remember seeing Ashley Wool post her self-tape and trying not to cry on the train as I'm watching an autistic actor unmask and perform without trying to perform, so to speak, for an audition. And it just ruined me because it's something that it's not something I ever had the opportunity to do as an actor. It's not something I would have known I could do. It's not something I probably could do now. in general, in that show, to see hands flap, to see any form of simming or whatever that isn't, and no one is performing that, that is just who they are, is really powerful to me.
Yeah.
one of those things I was talking about earlier about people taking risks with their writing that might not be appreciated in the moment but will be is definitely a thing in How to Dance in Ohio with that book writing. I feel like Rebecca did with it must have been such a challenge because the autistic characters, you just kind of want to be with them the whole show. But the moments that, and I know the main criticism I've seen of the show is the moments that leave them. But it's so clear to me, the juxtaposition that they're trying to place with Dr. Amigo and his daughter, and then the neurotypical parents and their autistic kids, and the neurotypical characters making the mistakes that we typically associate with the autistic characters, that type of thing. The social cues, the not respecting boundaries, all of these things that are kind of negatively associated with. I said to somebody the other day that while cis white straight men like me do not really need representation, we're pretty good on that, but cis white straight autistic men have never been represented, in my opinion, the way they have been in How to Dance in Ohio, in that they're kind, respectable of boundaries, not rude, and just generally nice human beings. often see us being, like, in shows like Atypical and Good Doctor or whatever, just being not being treated, but acting poorly as well.
Right.
Lots of focus on the negative consequences of autistic traits. And it's very nice to see that as well in a show.
So I'll stay in my room and refresh my
Awesome. Let's move to our final section, something wonderful. Just something in musical theater that we are excited about or want to give a shout out to.
I'm excited for Teeth.
We're recording it, recording this on the night of their first preview. So definitely thinking about that show.
I saw that movie ages ago and when it came out, I saw the team who was working on it when Anna and Michael first announced. I was just like, "Yep, that's perfect." and now that it's finally here, like I need to get over to Playwrights and see that on my next day off. That is probably top of the list right now. Lempicka. I've been hearing about Lempicka for years. I think at least since it was at Williamstown. So I'm very, very excited for that. I think everyone's just getting out of Eden's way at this point. I want to see because Shayna's music is so good. I missed it off Broadway. Tommy.
Oh yeah. Another neurodivergent.
Yep.
Show.
It's funny because I've listened to the music a lot. I still don't know a hell of a lot about Tommy, but I've heard that Pete Townsend has come out in recent years and acknowledged that, we didn't have the words for this back then, but I would say that Tommy's autistic. And I'm just like, okay, what you got?
When I saw that show as a 12-year-old, when that tour was coming around, I never had related to, as a family member of someone who's autistic, I had never related to something more than that show at the time. There's more now, obviously. I'll just add, I saw the musical off-Broadway, The Connector.
Oh my God, I want to see that too. Yeah.
Which I thought was really fascinating.
I've heard it's a lot of people calling it his best score. Since Parade.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I feel like I've been thinking about it since I saw it. I think it's also interesting having it be a Jason Robert Brown show because, I mean, this is a whole nother episode on Jason Robert Brown, but I feel like his shows are all like, there are so many of his characters who are asshole men. And I feel like this show is kind of interrogating the asshole man. Like he's like moved on to actually like,
oh, that's
like
so
now
good.
I'm gonna,
that's so smart.
now we're gonna like dissect asshole men instead of just showing them as characters in my work.
I definitely feel like that's what men need to be bringing to the table.
Yeah.
my adaptation of Wings of the Dove, it helped me move forward with it, despite the fact that most of the characters are, the protagonists are women. Everything infecting them in that story is just patriarchal nonsense. Like it's just, I refer to one of the songs in that show that I wrote as a mantrum. It's gotta be a guy just being like, well, if not me, then nobody can have you. Me. Men need to not be writing Buffy the Vampire Slayer. They need to be writing male characters they need to be interrogating their own masculinity. And just interrogating all of that, more of that. Oh man, I need to see that show.
It just got extended again to March 17th, so there's still time.
Thank you all for listening to this episode of Scene to Song. You can write to scenetosong@gmail.com with a comment or question about an episode or about musical theater, or if you'd like to be a podcast guest. Love this podcast? Help it find more listeners by rating it on Apple Podcasts and leaving a review. Follow on Instagram @scenetosong, on Twitter or X @scenesong, and on Facebook @scenetosong with Shoshana Greenberg Podcast. Sign up for our monthly e-newsletter @scenetosong.substack.com and contribute to our Patreon @patreon.com/scenetosong. Where you'll get bonus material from many of the episodes. The theme music you are hearing is by Julia Meinwald, and check back in 2 weeks for our next episode.